From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The partial shutdown of the U.S. government extended into the new year as a meeting between President Trump and congressional leaders produced little hope of a settlement in the near term. A U.S. citizen was arrested in Russia on charges of espionage, prompting speculation in the U.S. that the Russians were seeking to use the detainee as a bargaining chip in other investigations. We take a look ahead at issues that will be in the news in 2019 in the U.S. and around the world. And the Democratic Republic of Congo awaits the results of elections held in late December. Panelists, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
First and foremost, we say happy. Hope it is happy as a new year. Let's start with the government shutdown. Again, negotiations right now seem to be at a stalemate. I do not see any easy resolutions going forward. Starting with you, Dan, where are the negotiating points? Now, where are the two sides standing right now? Do you see any wiggle room for a resolution in the short term?
As we entered the new year, Michael, a lot of people here in Washington were surprised that it had not been settled, that the government was shut down. Actually, depending how you measure these things, about a quarter of the government, but certainly seven very large departments where the workers were told either you are an essential employee and you have to show up and we're not sure if you'll get all of your paychecks at the beginning of the new year, or you were a worker who was told just stay home. The phrase was, you were furloughed. There were about 400,000 who had to work, not being sure when they'd get paid, 400,000 who had to stay at home and might get paid. And for the public also, it was disruptive. If you had a question about your taxes, you have to call the Internal Revenue Service. There was no one to answer the phone. The Department of Agriculture, because it was officially closed, that often meant that farmers might have questions that they wanted to ask the government, and there couldn't be answers. So it was a painful thing for a lot of people, and yet the real battle was between President Trump and the Democrats in Congress. They were the minority. Only on January 3rd did the Democrats become the majority party in the House of Representatives, and that's where things possibly could change. But the stalemate was that President Trump demanded more than $5 billion toward building a wall on the border with Mexico. And the Democrats didn't want to give him the money. The Democrats said, we favor border security. We'll put some money in the annual budget for that. Oh, maybe $1.3 billion, maybe some more than that. And the president insisted on the more than $5 billion. He thought that the people of the United States are on his side, that it's time to take a stand and have a safer border. Opinion polls seemed to favor what the Democrats were saying. Let's get the government open. Let's pass a measure that might keep the government open for a further 5 or 6 weeks while negotiations take place. But the stubbornness, as the new Congress began on January 3rd, was absolutely locked in place.
And Emily, we talked about this last week, and we noted that we had a deal before. There was a deal to keep the government open that was quite popular in both the Senate and the House. And then we didn't have a deal after President Trump heard from a certain conservative commentators and others. Who's really driving the position of the Trump government now? Is this more of a political ploy? Is this a political survival move? Or is there an honest concern about border security that only a wall will solve?
I think both, in a sense. I do think that, you know, there was this deal and then there wasn't, as you say, because certain conservative voices suggested that Trump would be caving, right, if he gave in on this. So there is a political element. You know, he launched his campaign and has spent most of his presidency talking about the need to have this border and the threat that immigration poses to this country, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that. That's the political element. But it also does come from this place of, you know, I think that he's honest when he says that he believes that a wall will solve our immigration problems, despite all of the voices who speak to the contrary. And I also think that on the other side, it's also political and out of honest concern, right? I think the Democrats think that it's politically a bad move to spend billions on this border wall and to cave now in this shutdown process. I also think that they honestly believe that that's not the right thing to do for the country.
That is a policy issue as well as a political issue.
Right. I think on both sides, it's political as well as principled.
So he doesn't want to give them a win, and they, the Democrats, don't want to give the president a win. That, I guess that's the political side.
Which gets to my next question, Dan, for you. Is there a win-win proposition? Because as it stands right now, it seems that there is no win-win resolution for this. Somebody has to lose in this particular proposition. And I worry that if a government shutdown is something that's effective as a tactic. Aren't we putting ourselves in a position for a perpetual shutdown?
Well, as the new year began and we were sort of, you know, trying to assess exactly where we are, there were some maybe, you know, very optimistic people who thought that there are compromises on both parts of the border security issue. First, the money side. If the president was demanding over $5 billion and the Democrats offering about one-third that amount, well, it's money. You could go halfway, maybe, you know, compromise on the money, on the number.
But the Democrats said one-third for border security, not a penny for the wall.
Well, there you are. That's the second part. I think on the money, you could compromise. On the words, that could be the more difficult part. If you're going for a total win, Democrats would never let the word wall be in the agreement. But the president would insist that the word wall be in the agreement. So would both sides possibly pull back from that, find other words, accept the notion of border security, let the word fence be in there again? And by the way, the president afterward could give speeches, could give offhand remarks, as he often does in the White House, in which he steps back a little bit, in which he says, that was a terrible deal. I always meant wall. I don't care that we said fence. All those things are verbally possible. But you know what? You have to get the U.S. government open. That's where almost everyone's mind was. So you'd have to reach compromises on the money and on the words. I didn't see it as impossible.
Negotiation, powers of persuasion, all of these things seem to have gone out the window, Emily. When you look at the situation now, as we finish up this topic, who are the honest brokers in this? Who are the people who are likely to be the voices of reason that bring sides to the table and get them to move? And I note that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been oddly silent, oddly quiet, I would say, during this negotiation. But I throw that name as a name out there. Who do you think will be honest brokers that can bring this to a resolution?
Well, I believe that Mitch McConnell recently said that he would only support it if support some kind of resolution if the president supported it. And the president's saying that he'll only support it if there's the $5 billion for the wall because it's too important to not have the wall. Right. So I don't know that I would call McConnell an honest or an impartial broker is the word that I'll use.
Okay.
I think that at this point, everyone has dug their heels in so deep. Right. So Nancy Pelosi is saying not a penny for the wall. Trump is saying, we'll just keep it shut for weeks. At some point, something has to give. There are people not getting paid. I think that as it goes on, you're going to see more and more people notice what it looks and feels like when the government is partially shut down. But I think up until this point, I don't know who has been the compromiser in the room, right? Is it Chuck Schumer? Is that the person that we're turning to get both sides to give in? And, you know, from the Democrat side, why would they give in? They're asking for the government to open and to give some money to border security. If they now say, we're now looking to 2020, if the Democrats say, well, actually, we did give Trump some of his wall money, that's their rallying cry for 2020. Yes, we actually did give this president, who we're saying is so bad, what he wanted. From Trump's perspective, he's now said it's too important. How do you give in? So I don't know how this bends without breaking.
Yeah, it is kind of an untenable situation as it stands right now. But I do want to note that as we enter, like, the second week of this, Congress does get paid. So that is
Congress gets paid. Yes, there are plenty of other people working who are not getting paid.
When our Congress does get paid, I think it's worth noting. Let's move on to the U.S. citizen arrested in Russia for espionage. Paul Whelan was arrested in Moscow on suspicion of spying. He is not a diplomat. He is not working for clandestine services by all reports. I'll start with you, and Emily, what else do we know about the accused and about the charges?
So we know that his family, that the Whelan family, stopped hearing from him on December 28th. We know that they say that he was in Moscow for a friend's wedding. We know that he's a Russophile who's been going to Moscow to Russia for at least a decade. We know that he was a Marine, but more recently was director of global services for an automotive components manufacturing firm based in Michigan. And we know that he is being held in a Russian detention center, and that Ambassador John Huntsman, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, finally yesterday, after almost a week of his detention, was able to have access. And we also know that the State Department complained to their Russian counterparts about the delay in getting access to their person. What we do not know is whether there is anything to corroborate the claim that he is a spy, or whether, as several former intelligence officials are saying, that this looks like they're trying to, the Russian side, is trying to use Mr. Whelan as a bargaining chip perhaps for Maria Butina, who admitted to being a Russian agent last month.
Dan, as Emily said, the fact that U.S. Ambassador John Huntsman was the one to go see the detainee lends some significance. It gives an indicator of the significance of what the U.S. thinks about this. Certainly it is important. Certainly it's significant. Are your sources telling you that this is legitimate? And is it likely being used as a bargaining chip in another investigation?
I found that people here in Washington were a little bit puzzled by the arrest. First, it was a reminder that there really are quite a few United States citizens who frequently go to countries that they are very interested in.
And he was a very enthusiastic person about Russia and Russian culture.
Why was that? They're just, you know, we have 300 million Americans and people have some very big interests, and if they have enough money to go places. And that generally was the explanation about Paul Whelan. But it also sort of was highlighted he's a head of security at an auto parts manufacturing company, BorgWarner. Security, people said it's not about spying. BorgWarner doesn't do anything in Russia. So there were things that were odd about Whelan and what he does. And, of course, it would be easy for the Russian security services to set him up, to make up a case. And so most people here in Washington seem to assume that that's what's going on, that the Russians were interested in the idea of a swap with Maria Butina, who's being held in prison here in the United States. And then Ambassador John Huntsman goes to visit the prisoner. Here's the high level that people really were expecting, that President Trump, who claims to have a good relationship with President Vladimir Putin, would call Putin, and Trump would call Putin and say, can we settle this? This guy is not a spy. You should let him out. And maybe Putin would get right to the point, and let's talk about a swap. But there's stuff going on that the two governments, I don't think, were telling us.
Emily, we got about a minute. We have this particular case. We have the Maria Butina case. We have a Chinese executive who's arrested in Canada. We watched sort of a shift, and some say a decline, in political processes throughout the world. Are we witnessing a decline and a shift and maybe a deterioration of diplomatic norms as well?
I think specifically in the Russian case, what happens when you expel diplomats from each other's countries is that there are fewer diplomats in both countries to handle consular cases such as these. On the case of why it was Huntsman and not the president's, I do think what we've seen from the case of Pastor Brunson, who was held in Turkey, is that when the president speaks out about it, on the one hand, it raises the profile, right, which can be good. It raises the visibility. On the other hand, it says, oh, this is a really valuable person, right? So maybe we don't let him go. So that there's this balancing act that governments and diplomats need to perform. Are we witnessing a decline in diplomatic norms? Look, if this is an innocent man, I don't think detaining an innocent person could ever be called a diplomatic norm. I don't think delaying consular access to an American, innocent or not, right? That person has, under the Vienna Convention, has a right to access from their own government. So is that a decline of diplomatic norms? Yes. Obviously, there have been worse hostage crises in the past, but certainly this pattern of high-profile people or not high-profile people getting taken and becoming high-profile cases very quickly, that's becoming a pattern. And that's something that I think we could watch for in 2019 and for the duration of the Trump administration.
Let's take a pause right there. We'll be back with more issues in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. And Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
Welcome back. Let's talk about 2019 as we start off this year. It sort of feels like going up on a roller coaster. Only we're starting off at the top and heading down fast. 2018 by any standard was quite a year. 2019 does portend to hold more of the same. I'll just name off a few of the issues that I see in the future, including maybe the conclusion of the Mueller investigation, Democrats taking control of the House of Representatives, the U.S. markets and the volatility in them. We have trade wars with China, immigration, health care, of course, the politics of GOP opposition to Trump. Dan, I'll throw it to you first. What do you see as some of the top issues coming forward for 2019 in the U.S.?
Michael, that was a great list. And I think that the thread that connects a lot of it from the Washington, D.C. point of view, where we all work, is Donald Trump. And still, the country and the world trying to get used to this new unconventional president. Now, okay, he's not new. Here we are in January. 2 years that he's been president of the United States. And yet his style is so different. And he has interjected himself in subjects, you know, like what should the interest rates be in the marketplace? Usually the Federal Reserve is independent, but the president has had big opinions on that all the time. They're making a mistake. They're raising the rates too much. The president himself says that his predecessors were willing to tolerate China, as he puts it, cheating on a lot of trade issues and copying and counterfeiting a lot of U.S. intellectual property. And he says he won't stand for it. So even, you know, Mr. Trump himself is boasting that he's so different. I think that still is the key to a lot of the upheaval that occurred. And that's where you get differences of opinion. Even as I travel all around the world, people have questions about Trump all the time. I would say that in general, I hear skepticism. But in every country I've gone to, there are always some people who say, you know, he might be right about this or he might be right about that, but they don't like his style. Or, hey, how about those statements that he makes out of the blue? Does he really mean it, what he says? Apparently, in 2019, that's not going to change, even though next year in 2020, he plans to run for re-election. And we don't know who the Democrat will be running against him. So by the end of this year, we'll know a lot more. I think it'll become clear who the leading Democratic candidates are. They won't have chosen one. And we'll also find out whether Donald Trump is adjusting his style in order to perhaps appeal to more American voters and increase his chance of getting re-elected. So far, he's not adjusting his style, and he's only depending on his little base.
Emily, I'll throw it to you. I want you to address your own list, of course, but first to address what Dan was just talking about in terms of the president's style, which certainly is different, if not even unique. He was a candidate who ran without a record of any public service of any kind, and now he does have a record. Are the issues with Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, as much about style as they are about substance at this point, about his record, his policies, and his effectiveness?
I think it depends on who you ask, right? So, for example, Mitt Romney, who's now the new senator from Utah and obviously an unsuccessful candidate for president himself, wrote this op-ed where he said, you know, it's not just about the policies, it's also about your character and the way you present your policies, which suggested, right, that he supports a lot of what Trump is doing. And he said, you know, I would support the wall, but doesn't like the way in which he's doing it. I think for another set of American people, the policies are themselves bad policies, and dressing them up with the kind of political language that we're used to, right, would only make it less obvious that they're bad policies. So both.
Both or neither,
depending on, you know, some people really like the style and the substance. Some people say, well, you know, I wish that he were just nicer about the way that he was trying to keep immigrants out of the country and starting trade wars with various countries. And some people are saying that both are offensive. But I did want to pick up on something that Dan said, which is that I think a big story of this year will be the Democratic race, which is still kind of a story about Trump, right? Who is the Democrat who's going to take on Trump in 2020? You've already seen in Elizabeth Warren's maybe running for president video. You've already on Twitter seen Bernie Bros and Beto Bros, or the two camps that very staunchly support Bernie Sanders and Beto O'Rourke.
I think Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, has also formed a committee.
They're in there. Sherrod Brown. Yeah, it's going to take up a lot of time and energy this year tracking who that candidate is going to be, and we are almost 2 years out. And then the final thing that's on my list is several economists, or many economists, or however many you want to say it is, believe that we're headed toward a recession. If there is a recession, that becomes the big domestic political story.
And just to clarify, I think this is right. A recession is not a slowdown in economic growth. It's some shrinkage.
Mm-hmm.
A recession would say that America is producing less. And by the way, if the United States goes into a recession, so will the other major countries. That's really bad for incumbents who seek re-election.
I totally agree. And neither one of you mentioned it by name, but I still think the Mueller investigation will determine where this presidency, where this country, and maybe the rest of the political world goes.
Although it's worth keeping in mind that the president has made clear that Robert Mueller, the investigator, as Trump and his loyalists put it, is someone not to be trusted, right? That if it's not Mueller himself, who has a good record as a United States Marine and FBI director and prosecutor, okay, but Mueller's team, according to Trump, contains so many Democrats who are biased. So there'll be a lot of people in the country who will reject the Robert Mueller report. It's just worth keeping in mind.
Very, very true. And again, the response of the report does not diminish the importance of the report itself, it will throw a bomb into this presidency. And I think it'll determine whether that president is going to have really four effective years or not. Let's go to the international scene and some of the things on my list very quickly. U.S.-Russia relations, U.S.-China relations, the rise of authoritarian populism, sort of a realignment going on in the Middle East, U.S. pullout of Syria being sort of the most recent chess piece in that to have moved, Brexit and the state of Europe overall. These are just a few of the things on my list. Emily, I'll start with you first. What are the things at your top of the list to look for in international world news?
Well, the one that's been on the top of my mind, because Secretary Pompeo was just in Brazil. Well, actually, he was just in Colombia, but before that, he was just in Brazil. Speaking of an authoritarian populist, this is quite a far-right leader, President Bolsonaro, who has already said that he's going to shut down the human rights ministry and put a conservative evangelical pastor in charge of women's rights, LGBTQ rights, indigenous people's issues. Pompeo went there and said that the U.S. is so excited to have this new partner in democracy and human rights because Bolsonaro has said that they will work together against China and against or and for human rights, not in Brazil, but in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. And obviously, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban also joined together in Brazil. So this kind of alliance of defense of human rights in countries that we don't like, right? I think that's going to be a big trend in 2019. And it's going to involve partnering with some characters with whom the U.S. maybe in the past would have either not partnered with or been less gleeful about partnering with, right? Like to say that Bolsonaro, who on day one said, yeah, we're going to strip LGBTQ rights, to have Trump say this is, or have Pompeo rather, the Trump administration say this is our partner in human rights and democracy, that's a big story. And you have it in other countries too, right? You see what's happening to minority rights in India. You see what's happened. I mean, it took the murder of Jamal Khashoggi for people to start talking about human rights in Saudi Arabia seriously. This kind of decline of human rights around the world, that, to me, is one of the big stories of 2019.
Great take. Dan?
Well, again, because we're sitting in Washington, I'll devote a few more words to President Trump and the world. And even regarding what you were talking about, Emily, President Trump says, I don't care about foreign countries. Literally, early in January, he said, I don't care about Europe. Apparently, what he meant was, I don't care about European public opinion. If I were popular in Europe, I wouldn't be doing my job. I'm making them pay. He wasn't that clear what for, as usual, pay for their own defense instead of taking advantage of the United States. He said the same thing in the Middle East, that it's local powers who should take care of the Syria problems. It's locals like Turkey who should take care of ISIS, the terrorist group. And so Trump thinks he's saying something that American voters will absolutely love. Let the world take care of its problems. We have to build up the United States. And if the United States isn't really interested in human rights overseas and doesn't really care whether a foreign leader is a right winger or a left winger, that means that President Trump's comfortable with the right wing when they get elected in countries like Hungary and Poland and others. But it doesn't make a difference. And a lot of Americans don't care either. Okay, but back to the things that do matter around the world. There are still people who are working hard and wanting freedom and want to actually believe in something and that things can be better. But it's been a kind of depressing time. If there would be worldwide prosperity, maybe everyone would get a little richer and education would be better and there'd be more foreign travel and people going to foreign universities. But that's all actually on a downswing right now. So I think it's been kind of a sad time to think about making progress in most parts of the world. And a lot of worldwide surveys have indicated that folks just think about their own families. I'll be okay. I'll work hard. I don't know what's happening in my country. I think that's a sad trend, but I think it's a real one.
Just to throw my own in there, I do think that I agree with both of you. And to try to place it in my own words, I think that the decline of sort of global humanitarianism and combined with this sort of aggressive authoritarian populism is creating a situation that, along with the dismantling of post-World War II institutions, is leading to a time that gives people this sort of fear of the other and possibly of the future. As we say, 2019, let us hope that it is, in fact, a happy new year. Before we leave, I just wanted to report on the elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There were elections in late December. Election monitors have said that the election went, quotes, relatively well, despite some chaotic scenes that prevented many from voting. The election is meant to lead to Congo's first democratic transfer of power in 59 years of independence. And we do hope that, in fact, there will be a just and peaceful outcome in these elections. That is all the time we have for this week. Our thanks to Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based Channel I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor. Thanks for listening.